Returning to our show now is Dr. Sean O'Neill to tell us a little bit today about sleep, something that we all do a third of our lives in some cases. Everyone does it every night, and yet it's a very mysterious business.
Yes, it is, and not all of us are getting a third of our lives worth, hence the problem.
You know, I always find it fascinating that they talk about REM sleep and this sleep and that sleep, but the basic question, why do we sleep, appears to be unknown.
Yep, it is. Absolutely. Not only is it unknown, but the more we study it, about the only thing we've succeeded in doing is breaking it down into little pieces that we give names to based on what happens with electroencephalographic evidence.
Well, you know, it's animals do it, and some animals seem to do it a lot. Some animals seem to do it hardly at all. So, I mean, it isn't about repairing the body, apparently. There's something else going on.
True enough. And there are some people, very few, but there are some who don't do it at all. Usually people who have had some sort of weird shock in their life and tend to be war veterans who just got out of the habit.
Well, I think most of us have trouble sleeping at some point or another, and that's why we have a little nightcap, a cocktail. We try and do warm milk. There's all sorts of solutions. What advice do you have for the insomniac out there?
Well, it depends a good deal on whether the problem is getting to sleep or staying asleep. Getting to sleep is actually the easier of the problems to deal with. One of the principal causes of insomnia, in the sense of you are having difficulty getting to sleep, is one is having your nightcap immediately before going to bed, because that will mess up your ability to either get to sleep or sleep soundly. We aren't talking about going into a coma here, okay. But that will inhibit your ability to go to sleep. To sleep, your body needs to cool down. So luxuriating in a really hot bath prior to going to bed is a bad idea.
So my ritual of a little glass of Kahlua and milk and taking the hot bath before I go to bed every night is counterproductive.
Yeah, you've got it completely wrong.
But yet I go to sleep just fine.
You would probably go to sleep just fine standing on one foot leaning against a barbed wire fence, too. You're just one of those people who can do it.
Well, maybe so.
We aren't talking about people like you.
Okay.
We're talking about people who have difficulty getting to sleep. So, on the other hand, if you were to have your hot bath an hour or an hour and a half before going to bed, then that raises your body temperature and allows you to then cool off, and that act of cooling off will help you go to sleep. The other thing to do is to establish an absolute unbroken ritual about what time you go to sleep and what you do for the hour or so prior. So, if you want to make it your bath...
I'm doing everything wrong.
Well, yes, but it doesn't matter for you because
right.
You still do it.
Right.
There are some people who have a natural gift of being able to sleep, and you should run with yours.
So people need to do the same thing, unwind, sort of an unwinding process every night.
That's a very good way of putting it. Whatever your unwinding process is, then this becomes the cue to the body that, okay, we're unwinding, we're going to go to sleep. The other thing you want to pay careful attention to is the bed in the bedroom is for sex and sleeping, and that's it. Not for watching TV, not for reading books, not for sorting your laundry at 2 o'clock in the morning, solely for sleeping and sex.
So there's a certain conditioning process of people that sort of go on the bed and read a magazine or whatever that was counterproductive.
Absolutely.
I'll be darned.
If you watch TV in bed, that's also counterproductive. If you see the evening news in the evening while lying in bed and the evening news upsets you, then obviously you're going to have more difficulty going to sleep. Whereas if you're watching the evening news sitting in your living room, you've differentiated those two places somewhere in the basement of your brain, and you can leave your troubles in the living room, as it were, because the bedroom is where you sleep.
Well, okay, you've done your ritual, you've cooled off, you've relaxed, you've unwound, you've been sure to keep your bed so that you're conditioning to go to sleep in that bed, and you're still having trouble. What can you tell us about some of the supplements and things which I know you have some familiarity with that are out there?
Well, there's the Western medicine has come up with any number of sleep aids that up until recently have been all pretty much based on either barbiturates or benzodiazepines.
And the barbiturates would include like phenobarbital.
Yeah, they have the unfortunate side effect of people dying from them, but
they can suppress your breathing if you take enough dose.
That's okay. Right.
So they're powerful drugs and somewhat dangerous, but used in a pinch.
They work like a hot damn if you can get over that small part of not breathing.
Okay. And then benzodiazepines are drugs like Valium, the class of drug.
That's right. And with benzodiazepines, you can basically take a truckload of them without doing any real serious harm to yourself, other than you're just going to feel like crap the next
very,
day.
Very safe drugs. But the problem, you know, these Ativan, Xanax, Valium-type drugs, people don't realize they have what are called half-lives of, like, what, 12 hours? They stick around.
Valium's got a half-life of 23 hours.
So you take a dose, and half of it's still around the next day.
Yeah,
quarter of it's still around 2 days later.
That's right. And if you take it every night, then by the fourth or fifth night, you've built up a level in your system that would put you to sleep for 2 or 3 days.
Now, one drug I have some familiarity with is Halcyon, which is a short-acting benzodiazepine, which has basically got a half-life of, like, what, 2 hours? So by the morning, most of it's gone out of your system. And I've had good luck with it, but it's sort of gotten a bad rap in the press.
Well, I think the bad rap is primarily related to the psychosis supposedly associated with it. And it doesn't matter what it is. If you give the drug to enough people, you're going to have somebody who has a what they call an idiopathic bad reaction. Right. And I think Halcyon is a great drug. If you happen to be one of the very few people who have a bad reaction to it, well, you know, don't take it. That's not rocket science.
That has been my experience as well. And Halcyon has gotten a bad rap somewhat unfairly. Another one that I guess the other drug that you're liable to get from your doctor is Ambien.
Now, Ambien is a different class, and they're a relatively new class of drug outside of the benzodiazepine family. And I haven't looked at them in detail, but they work at a different receptor site in the brain than the benzodiazepines. The benzodiazepines are what are called a GABA receptor interferer. So they interfere with the movement of a chemical in your brain that's called GABA. And as a result of that, it sort of indirectly turns things off. The Ambiens, work, as I understand it, on calcium channels, but I'm not sure how they work on calcium channels in the brain without affecting the calcium channels in, say, for your instance, your heart. So that's a puzzle to me at this point in time. There's a number of other drugs in the Ambien family that are being studied at the moment. One is called Zolpidem. It has been in use in Canada and Europe for quite a number of years. It has a very good profile. It's even better than Ambien. It's under investigation and trials by the FDA at the moment. It's probably going to be available within the next year.
So for people that have serious problems with insomnia, you can go to your doctor, you can get Halcyon, you might get Ambien or something related to it, and you'll do fine. Most of us, however, most people that have occasional insomnia do not ever wind up going to a doctor with that complaint. There are a number of things over the counter that have been talked about. Two I want to address with you. The first, less so. The second I want to go into some detail on. The first one is melatonin. The second one is kava. Tell us a little bit about melatonin.
Well, melatonin is a brain chemical, for lack of a better term, that is used by the brain in setting the clock. And the clock is related to the rising and setting of the sun, the phases of the moon, and God knows what else. But the primary thing is the sun. We, as human animals, are set up to stay roughly in one place on the planet, and our clock is set by the rising of the sun.
Which I think is just fascinating, that the sun resets you all the time.
What's even more fascinating is that we can mess with this, and this is when you have jet lag. If you go to a rainy climate or a dark climate, if you were going, say, in the summer from San Francisco to Antarctica, your clock would not reset. It would stay just as it is, regardless of what the time frame was for other people, and you would just feel like hammered crap because there's nothing to reset your clock. Whereas if you go from a gray environment, such as Vancouver, Canada in the winter, and you were going to Hawaii or the desert or something like that, your internal clock resets very quickly within a day or so. It also resets. Moving your clock forward is easier than moving it back. So if you go to Europe, it's easier to reset your internal clock than if you go to the Far East, to Japan, for instance.
So this is why people, this resetting of the clock with the melatonin is why people have such problems, among other reasons, with jet lag.
Yeah, the melatonin is generally used to deal with jet lag, and it's a very nice drug in that respect. It can take what would be a 3 or 4 day period of jet lag and change it in a day to 2 days.
I've never really quite understood the regimen that one is supposed to use. It's very unclear to me. Is that clear to you what you're supposed to do?
I haven't looked at it in detail.
All right, well, then we'll leapfrog over it and come back to it, because the logic was a little bit puzzling to me.
Well, it also comes out of the fact that nobody really truly understands how the pineal gland resets any of the clock anyway.
Oh, great. So just take the drug, but take the drug in some fashion. We just can't tell you how.
Well, the other thing you can do is just sleep with the light on. If you're going on a trip and you're one of the people like yourself who can sleep anywhere, anytime, then if you leave your light on or you put it on a timer so that it comes on, despite the fact that you are asleep, there'll be enough light going through your eyelids that it will register in your little brain and you will start resetting your clock. And in fact, they are doing experiments with people whose clock are badly upset. They have these special glasses that detect when the patient is asleep and then add an increasing amount of light.
Interesting.
And that will reset the clock despite the fact that they're asleep.
Sounds very promising. Now, kava has been in the news lately, and there's been some allegations that perhaps it isn't as safe as we all thought, yada yada. But this interesting drug has been used in Polynesia, or I guess Melanesia, down in the South Pacific for a long time. It's now being sold as a supplement all over the Rite Aids and Long's Drugs of America. Seems to work, does it not?
Kava, as you know, is one of my pet interests, so you're sort of unleashing a can of worms when you ask me questions about kava.
Well, why don't you actually, this might be a good point to actually back up a little and just tell the story about how you first were exposed to it while in the South Pacific. I find that very interesting.
Well, I went to Vanuatu on a holiday.
Which used to be the New Hebrides Islands in World War II. It's right, near New Guinea.
Yeah, it's the one. It's famous for having these chaps dive off these very high towers with vines tied to their
feet. The old National Geographic specials back in the 60s.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're always showing that.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the area of the world it was in. I had some kava in the resort that I was staying at and was very unimpressed.
It was a big ceremony. I guess when you go to places like Samoa and Tonga, they give you a little bowl of kava as a ceremonial.
Well, they do it in the resorts. They go through, it's like everything else that takes place in a tourist resort. They've kind of touristed it up and diluted it down. And, you know, it's all very Western and clean and pretty, right, and yaddy, yaddy, yaddy. Uh-huh. And,
you know, like, so you get this little coconut shell full of mud.
Yeah.
Mud-like liquor.
That's right. And it's more water than kava, and that way, you know, no one has a bad effect, and the tourists get to brag that they had a kava ceremony, and they're all, well, that's wonderful. But subsequent to that, I went out to one of the outer islands, and it was mentioned to the chief of the island that I didn't think very much of kava. I thought it was extremely overrated. And this, needless to say, didn't go over particularly well with the chief, who quite rightly so, said that I hadn't had real kava, I just had the crap that they serve in the resorts. So he arranged for me and friends to have king's kava. And the king's kava is extremely potent. King's kava is actually planted 5 generations in advance, so that the age is in excess of 100 years. Uh-huh. Most kava is aged 3 or 4 years.
Okay.
And it gets more potent with each year. So by the time you get to 100-year-old kava, you've got some pretty mean stuff.
So they mixed you up a bowl of this concoction.
Well, it's not exactly mixed. That's part of the interesting thing, is that kava is a sacred plant, and it was had to be chewed by virgin boys. So you have to picture sitting in a clearing in the forest in a small island at night with the only light being from a kerosene lamp, surrounded by a number of young boys chewing kava and spitting it onto a banana leaf.
Mm-hmm.
So all around you, there's the sound of horking. Then it's put into a cheesecloth, water is poured through into your kava cup, and you have this vision of having every disease ever known to man. And then you slug back the kava, which tastes somewhat muddy. And you've got about probably 2 minutes before you are flying high, as it were. The path from the hut that I was staying in to this clearing was absolutely dead flat level.
Uh-huh.
And I obviously had no particular difficulty negotiating it on the trip to the clearing. Unfortunately, coming back from the clearing, I could not stay on the path. I kept falling down what seemed to be an incredibly steep slope and would actually have to crawl back to the path to continue on.
So was it like being drunk?
It had almost no resemblance to being drunk, except that I felt odd.
You just couldn't make things work?
I just couldn't make things work. One of the things about the uses of kava, alcohol tends to allow emotions to come out. People get very emotional and they get into fights and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Kava has exactly the opposite effect. You don't feel emotional about anything. You're very logical and you're just not affected by the emotional overlay that mm-hmm. presents in most problems.
Slurring your speech. You're not.
No, you're not.
Stumbling around.
Well, I was stumbling, but I had an extremely high dose for someone who never had it, too.
Okay.
For the most part, people don't stumble around. You get enough. Eventually, if you take enough, you'll just go to sleep.
Okay.
But the interesting thing is the difference between in alcohol is that you just don't get the... You don't want to get up and fight. You just want to sit back and contemplate the universe.
Well, it sounds very different than the experience I think most of us can relate to with having imbibed too much alcohol. You don't contemplate the universe when you're drunk.
No, you tend to contemplate your feet or the bottom of the toilet. But...
So beyond any shadow of a doubt, kava is an effective way of getting one to relax and perhaps go to sleep.
There is no doubt. How kava works is a great mystery, however, because they've identified at least 13 active ingredients in it, and no one active ingredient seems to have any significant effect, and yet the bunch of them working together have a synergistic effect, so the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
Is this FDA warning a little overblown?
I haven't heard what the FDA warning is. The basic FDA warning for everything is this can cause cancer, may cause this, has been known if you bury a rat in a truckload of it, will make their toenails fall off, that kind of thing. It's like every other FDA warning. There will be some people who are sensitive to kava. There will be some people who have allergic reactions to kava. There will be some people who go to sleep with it. If you're going to make a habit out of doing any medication, and kava is a medication. You need to start with a low dose, see how you react to it. Don't try it at home all by yourself. You want to have somebody around who, in case you're one of these very rare people that has a bad reaction, you can get medical help.
Right.
But you need to remember that this has been used for at least 3,000 years that we know of. And it may have been used for up to 6,000 years. Mm. The Polynesians seem to be doing quite well, thanks.
So I take that as a qualified endorsement of it as a fairly safe drug for people who need to occasionally use something to help them fall asleep.
It's a qualified endorsement.
Because, the other thing they do sell, we're just about out of time, but they do sell antihistamines out there, dicyclamine, they sell these Benadryl, they sell these. If you've ever taken an antihistamine to sleep, you'll find out two things. One, it works. And number two, good luck waking up the next morning.
You get a hangover. It's the same as benzodiazepines. Not only do you have good luck getting up in the morning, but you feel like you could probably drink the output from the Mississippi River for the next 500 years.
Your mouth is so dry.
That's right. Antihistamines, the sleepiness aspect, is a side effect.
Right.
So if you're taking a drug to get the side effect, you're going to have to deal with what its major component is. The effect. And the effect of an antihistamine is to dry you out.
As allergy sufferers know too well. A very interesting segment. Thank you, Dr. Sean O'Neill.
You're very welcome, Doug.
Well, thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to an encore performance of Radio Parallax, and we'd like to put in a special thanks to Gina, whose show follows ours, for playing this for us on this Thanksgiving holiday. Thanks, Gina. We urge you listeners to stay tuned for the next 2 hours for Gina's program, where she will play for you a most eclectic and interesting selection of music. We will see you again next Thursday at 5 o'clock. I am your host, Douglas Everett, and this was Radio Parallax.